Welcome to Talking Books on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and in this series I discuss books and what they mean to my guests on the program. I'm very happy to have with me in the studio today on Talking Books, Professor Arnold Cassola. Just a few words about my guest before we start to chat. Professor Cassola lectures in Maltese and comparative literature here at the University of Malta and is the author and editor of a number of books and many academic papers. He was a founder member of the Alternativa Democratica, the Green Party here in Malta, and has held elective office and political posts in Italy and at a European level in Brussels. Professor Cassola was made Cavaliere della Repubblica Italiana in 2003 by Italian President of the Republic, Carlo Azeglio Ciampi. I'm always rather embarrassed by the reductive nature of these potted bios, but clearly you'll understand, Professor, that time is short on the radio programme.
It's more than sufficient, I would say.
Welcome to you, first of all.
Thanks, and to all our listeners, too.
When I first mooted the idea of your participation in this programme, you told me that rather than talk about a particular book, you'd prefer to talk about reading and the process of reading, and then perhaps something about newspapers, which was something new on this program for me. So I'm really looking forward to hearing about various aspects of newspaper reading and today and the newspapers of yesteryear as well. What about your early days as a reader? How do you remember your introduction to books?
I remember it very well. It's still vivid in my mind, really. As a child, I used to read a lot, especially these Enid Blyton books, Noddy and Tessie and Big Ears and so on. And I even remember my fantasy that every time I would reread the books, and every time, according to me, the pictures would change. The illustrations were different. And I was convinced it was like that. So, and I would reread the books and so this is something in my childhood, which I remember, in my early childhood, and in my older childhood, 10 years old, 9 years old, 11. I still remember my father taking me every Saturday to Valletta. My father was a man from Valletta, so the Valletta people I can't understand because I'm a slimmer person, but they have something which they're attached to Valletta. And so we had to go to Valletta every Saturday, apart from watching the march pass by, you know, which I still remember, the main guard. Then we used to go to the premiere at that time, and my father used to meet these intellectuals, Giuseppe Cuti, Rosar Briffa. They would sit for 4 hours, still more or less till lunchtime, in Valletta at a cafe. And I would go up to the National Library, which at that time, the first floor where today you pay your fees or whatever, was the lending library, which we now have at Beltisep. I used to borrow 3 books every Saturday, go down, and I would manage to read, you know, these Biggles, Secret 7, Famous 4, Famous 5, I forgot the titles exactly, and I would read a whole book in those 3-4 hours, go back up quickly before they closed at 1, and I remember them getting very angry at me every time, because they would think that I, you know, was just wasting their time.
They didn't believe that you had actually read
the book. So, I mean, I was brought up in a house with books and around me. So even if I didn't, you know, didn't do it naturally, there were always books around, which more or less you leave them. So
the titles you've mentioned, like, you know, Blyton titles, some purists would say, you know, oh, well, that's it's not very sophisticated children's literature. But I know that my parents used to say, well, it doesn't matter really what you read, so long as you get the bug.
Well, I used to enjoy them, so I don't know. Maybe I was an undergrown child or an overgrown child. I don't know what these purists or psychologists say. I mean, and there's a lot of also, I see psychological interpretation of what the big ears mean and what they were. But as a child, really, I just remember enjoying
the stories.
Goes
over your head, really. Yeah.
So
exactly.
I don't want to go into stretch myself too much on this.
And in fact, the premiere was this sort of Ritrovo, this place where the Maltese intellectuals used to meet up?
Not only, because then in the evening there was another one, which was the Allies Bar in the Ferries, which today is one of these, again, modern bars and so on. It's in the corner, and then what was Bonello's kiosk at that time? It was a very small place where the theatre people used to meet, because my father used to write plays and was an actor. They were in Mahlet. My mother was the secretary of Mahlet. Again, I was this was before television even was there. So I'm talking about 56, 57, 58. I was 5 years old, 4 years old, 6 years old, and we used to live in Rudolph Street, more or less by the police station, so we used to walk down. We had no television, of course, we had no car. And they used to meet there and so on. And I still remember this guy, I think he was Mary Camilleri's husband, the actress. His name was Walter Camilleri, I think. And he used to scare me with this glass eye, which he used to put in his eye. And I really used to get scared, I remember. So I remember these people, Francis Abeyre. They used to meet and talk about theatre in these, you know, old typical Maltese pastizzi bar, the Allies bar, with these tables of marble tables and these brass stools, sort of, and so on. And then I remember on the way back around 9:30 in the evening, going up the hill, and I would say, my father, lift me up, and I always would get the answer, salvut up. You know, the poetic rhyme was always there. So there were places in those times, I suppose. And these are my childhood memories, which are...
Well, if you kept that kind of company, one can imagine that it would influence you in the right direction.
Probably be boring company, I suppose, but the eye I still remember. So. But then I got into acting myself. I was a child actor, I was a child singer. I mean, these are all parts of my biography. Uh-huh. 5-6 years of my life, acting and until I was 13 and singing.
Gosh, yes. This is a side of you I really didn't know anything about.
I won the Canarinta Fidda, I was various times abroad singing.
And I see.
Home is full of trophies. At that time it was more trophies than in Maltese politics, definitely.
And what was your taste, as a teenager, or as you were starting towards university, aiming in that direction? Yes, what kind of books did you read?
I used to read all sorts of books, to be honest. History, especially... But I must admit, literature, a lot, novels, enormously, classical novels, English especially, of course. But then I think university actually killed a part of my taste of reading, in the sense that, of course, it became my profession. Later on, it became, I was studying literature, so the reading, the kind of reading changed. It was not anymore reading for pleasure, but looking for things in a text. And I think, of course, that's my job. I enjoy it. It's an investigative thing. It's a detective work. But you don't read it for pleasure. You don't read for pleasure. Or I don't actually read for pleasure. If I have to read for pleasure, you know, I just buy an Italian newspaper that I enjoy, because there are all sorts of, you know, scandals. At least things come out in Italy. Very different from Malta, except for one newspaper, I think. You get very little of all that's happening on the ground here. So,
what about poetry?
Poetry was not my... No, I wouldn't say that. My father was a poet, apart from being a novel writer himself. My grandfather was a novel writer, John Marx. My father, Albert Cassola. Different styles, different genres, different political orientations, obviously. Grandfather was very labor... socio-realist, the socio-realist writers, he's amongst them. He was the one who introduced the 1st of May in Malta. He was, you know, unions and so on. My father, on the other hand, was very nationalist, friend of George Bolshevik, grew up door to door, more Italian background. My grandfather was Marx, his English background, and he didn't like the Italians, so... had some problems when my mother met my father, from what I gathered, and so on also. But I wouldn't read. I remember knowing some poems by heart at school, St. Joseph's, that I know, I remember. But it's something I can't. Today is something I can't understand learning things by heart. I can understand analysing a poem, yes. But not...
It's so difficult not to analyze.
And I don't have the declamatory skills, you know. I think, you know, you have to have a great voice, intonation, feeling, the right pauses, I don't have that. So I'm not the right person to...
And
I teach poetry, but uh-huh. I'm not a creative. I'm certainly not creative poetry.
Yes, to appreciate a poem, obviously, you don't have to necessarily
No, you can see how it's built, how it's constructed, what words have been used, what have been left out, what position they've been put, etc.
This problem with not being able to always look at things in a professional way, it happens to a lot of people.
In any job, I suppose. But normally in a technical job, in a scientific job, people read books to relax on the beach and so on. I could never read a book on the beach. Maximum is an Italian newspaper, again, not...
What about the newspapers, which I'm hoping you'll yes. talk about? Because it's a very special genre, isn't it? Newspaper writing, a newspaper collection.
But it's not, I'm not talking about modern, I like reading a modern newspaper on the beach, of course. But when I'm talking about newspapers, I mean old Maltese newspapers especially, considering the fact that Malta had a printing press very late, basically 1750s. And so basically, that's one of the reasons why Maltese didn't develop earlier, and one of the main reasons. There was nowhere to print anywhere in Maltese. So the 19th century hundreds of newspapers were printed in Malta after the, even some before. Some were actually printed before March 1839, when the British gave the Freedom of Press Act. And we had Il Caulata Maltia, L'Arlecchino, a lot of old Maltese newspapers, which influenced the language, the development of the language. So when you have a good number of papers which were being written by intellectuals, most of whom were of an Italian background, Gianton Vassallo, Richard Taylor, Giuseppe Muscatazzoppardi, most of these people started writing in Italian, Brighella, but then they wrote in Maltese. They were the transition between Italian and Maltese came natural to these people. Not to all, obviously. Many continued just writing in Italian, but they had a problem: what alphabet to write with? We didn't have an alphabet until 1924, and so everybody invented their own alphabet. And you have all these polemics, which you can see in these newspapers: Salvatore Cumbo, Francesco Vella, Circa Semia, Eduardo Cacchia, Bellanti, etc. All Il Filologo with Gelanton, Vassallo, Ludovic Messu Tomasi, everybody proposing their own alphabetic code to transcribe the Maltese language. So it's a very vivid period where you not only have political things, because most of the newspapers originated politically, because they were the British gave freedom of press.
That's always interesting, I think, for people who perhaps don't follow the Maltese history very closely. The idea that the British gave the freedom of the press, we have this idea of the British holding freedom of the press to their hearts, but in actual fact, I think it was a political move, wasn't it?
It was a big political move, because this way, Malta was invaded by Italian Risorgimento exiles, who had been defeated in 1821, when Greece managed to obtain its independence, with Byron dying, fighting in Missolunghi, etc. But the Italians didn't, so obviously the losers had to escape. And the two comfortable places to escape to were Corsica and Malta, for very simple reasons. One, they were very near Italy, so you could keep in touch with Italy 50 kilometers away, 60 kilometers away. Even in those times, you were much closer. Especially in those times, you could get... And two, they were Italian-speaking. Both Malta and Italy, and Corsica, sorry, were Italian native speakers. So this is why then they published the newspapers, and then after 1848, the second wave of Risorgimento exiles came here. Again, the defeats... before then, the successful 1860-61, and these people, and the British cunningly thought, why not give them freedom of press? I mean, these people are fighting against our enemies, the Austrians, the French, the Borboni, the Spaniards, and the Pope. These are our enemies, great, let them do that. And so we had all these newspapers which were published and printed here, and many were sent back to Italy as propaganda. But obviously, the young Maltese intellectuals were reading these newspapers and were being imbued by these ideas. And 50 years later, this turned against the British, because the same ideas which the British had encouraged against French, Austrians, Spaniards and the Pope were then used against them. And in fact, the nationalist movement in Malta, 1880s, started with exactly the same ideas which the British themselves had. But these are the twists of history, you know. History comes back to haunt you eventually.
Yes, or to bite you.
So you have these political things, obviously, and then the language, you said, the alphabet, literature, eventually, poems, a lot, poetry, literary exercises, even novels, but short stories are the novels, but even the historical novel. For example, the historical novel in Malta, Romanzo Storico, the Walter Scott thing, and the Manzoni, started off in the Corriere Mercantile di Malta, where we had Finotti, who used to have these romanzo in fascicoli, feuilleton. So every issue would have a short chapter of novels, historical novels, all based in Malta, in Italian. In Italian. But this set the model. So when you have then Caterina Taleridum, it's Caterina del Redum written by these people in the novels. When you have Giuseppe Cioè Lutonna, all these things based on the 1565 siege, most of the issues, Tony Baiada, by Giuseppe Moscatasuo, they had been written in Italian. These are translations or adaptations of what had happened there, because Giuseppe Moscatasuo Pardi himself, Fortunato Mizzi, Zaccaria Roncalli, all started writing in Corriere Mercantile di Malta in Italian. So you have a lot of historical, political, cultural, linguistic, alphabetic influences, and it's something which I have tried to develop in a different way in a publication which will soon be published here in Malta.
The interesting thing, I think, one of the interesting things about newspapers is the way that they were used in actual fact. You've mentioned the fact that these stories would come out in chapters,
yes,
and the popularity could be gauged, really, through the enthusiasm of people to buy the newspaper.
In fact, these had to be created, like Dickens and others. They had to, and Walter Scott, same thing. To sell the newspaper with the normal news, you had to have a chapter which attracted people, which obviously had to end always with a question mark. It's like this. It's like Dallas Dynasty and all these soap operas, which always leave you there and say, "Oh, what's going to happen?" So next day you have to watch the other thing. So next day you buy the newspaper, mm-hmm, and I can imagine these authors having to write continuously, produce something because they have to fill in the paper and be able to sell it. So it was a good technique, I see, and which left a lot to literature, and which gives us a lot about Maltese history. So at the moment I've finished working on newspapers in the 19th century in Maltese, but which are lost. So,
and are there a lot of them that are lost?
There are a lot, there are quite a lot. We know of, I would say, 15 more or less, which more or less I know of through. So basically this is reading other newspapers to see what they say about these newspapers, which do not exist in public libraries, because I'm sure that some do exist in private collections. And
probably people don't even know, people, they've got them stuck in their attic somewhere.
Wouldn't know, others I'm sure that would, and maybe this might also encourage some people to come up. In fact, during my work, I'm talking to Dr. Albert Ganado, he actually came up with one of these newspapers, of which he has a whole collection, which does not exist anywhere. Very
not much Melitensia he doesn't know about.
He's a very generous also.
Yes.
But he has an idea of what culture is and culture sharing is.
Yes.
It's not the people who, you know, have something and treasure it because it's money. Of course these things cost money because they're old. But most people just invest, you know, instead of investing in a flat in Bubara or in Slema, you invest in old Melitensia. It's nice investing, but it's nice reading then the book, and knowing what you have. And it's nice even sharing, because at the end we're not all here for the rest of our lives. So it's good not losing. We're always talking about, this is my major concern in reality now at my age, we talk about identity, Maltese identity, and all this stuff. And yet, we know so little about ourselves. So trying to reconstruct even little things in different eras, 15th century, 16th century, which have a, you know, which are part of our Malteseness. When you have this big jigsaw, then you can really talk about Malteseness. But just talking about a Maltese identity with having many gaps, so trying to fill in the gaps helps, I think, you know. And we also with things which might not seem important, which might seem irrelevant or trivial. But, you know, if you have a great poet, it's also because there were 100 poets who were not great at all and who were just, you know, versificatori, the Italians would say. They would be there, a blu. But hadn't you had that humus, then you would not have been influenced. Hadn't you read, you know, Enid Bagir's, then you might not have been interested in another kind of literature. So I believe that this little social cultural work helps. In the creation of identity.
Because, as you say, sometimes our memories are selective.
Yes.
Whereas if you sort of look into the bigger picture, then there's less chance that the selectivity will narrow.
And I try and look at the minor people, the minor characters, the minor protagonists in life of Maltese history, culture, literature. I mean, normally the accent is on the major ones, Duncan. You know, or Zarbriffa, or, well, I think all these little people, and the names that will come up, even if you look at the index of my booklet eventually, there are so many names of people who actually were editor of a newspaper, but we know nothing about them. We have nothing about their biographies, so nobody knows about them. Now you start seeing that there were these, who was this guy, you know, Francesco Camilleri, but at least now we have a name. Maybe someday somebody starts looking around, meets something else, you know, Roberto De Cesare. These are people that are not in the National this excellent two-volume, thing which we need. But it shows you also what a lack of how many gaps still there are to fill of people who are Antonio Calleja. He was a singer, he was a musician, and he was the editor of a newspaper called La Frit, which still exists. Yes, La Frit, devil, shitan, making fun. Most of these newspapers were satirical, taking the mickey out of each other, and of course rivalries. Malta is a small place; it still is today. You can still see these personal, individual feuds going on. Mm-hmm. Even on today, we can use blogs instead, and you can use internet and whatever. But it was always the same thing. So trading insults, poem, making fun of caricature of you, and you will answer me back. Of course, it makes you laugh when you say, but it also shows you that plus ça change, et plus c'est la même chose. In this respect, I think we have not developed much.
What about the biblioteca? There are, I'm sure, a lot of listeners who know the biblioteca very well. Obviously, anybody who's at university has, I'm sure, at some point had occasion to use the biblioteca. I remember going in the first time to do some research, and I was amazed by the building itself, and okay. It is fascinating. Perhaps you could describe a little bit about the logistics of actually even accessing these newspapers.
Well, that's, I think, the best thing. You have three sources. That's where you start off. One is Bianca Fiorentini, Schiavone, and Bonello, Vincenzo Bonello. It's a book on which describes more or less the newspapers in between 1810 and 1870. Very short description of each, and so there you have a very strong basis. Another one is by Sapienza, the ex-university librarian, Jesuit, who had compiled a list of all the books, of all the newspapers, but all newspapers, more or less, that are present in the holdings of both the University of Malta and the public library. And then you have another booklet today by a lecturer in Italian, young Italian lecturer, the name Sergio Portelli, who has compiled sort of catalogue, Indice Analitico, with a very short description of all the newspapers that there are in the National Library. So I think...
Quite a job, that must have been...
Yes, yes. So I think, of course, I'm sure he must have used these other sources, but I think it integrates, because it goes beyond 1870. So one there can get an idea, starting point, of what are the holdings. Unfortunately, once in a while, you actually go there and you don't find it. It's misplaced or something, which is a pity. But more or less, there you can get a good idea of the... of the many of these, some of which are microfilmed and which are used as, you know, you have to read on screen, etc. But then once you start, then one thing leads you to another. So you get overawed as soon as you get into the library. If you don't know what you're looking for, sometimes, you know, that's a problem. So you would have, but if you're looking for a person, a famous person who lived in a period. Well, it's unless you can start off, but normally you can start off, if you have some reference, you start off from that. Mm-hmm. And then maybe you can find in one L'Ordine, you find a reference to Corriere Mercantile. And then you go and look at that, and maybe you find them trading in. So you have to also be a bit patient, and lucky too.
Yes,
as usual.
There's an element
because
of luck, yeah.
Most of the times you go looking for something and you don't find that, and then you end up finding something as you didn't even think about. And, I mean, when I think of my... major, say, recoveries, the Regole per la lingua maltese, the oldest dictionary of the Maltese language, mid-17th century, 150 years before Vassalli. I was writing a chapter in a book in Italy on the Italian language in Malta. So I was reading, actually, and about Italian culture, books, etc., in Malta. And I found a reference in the library in Rome, which sounded very strange, so I went to look there, and then I find this 250-page dictionary which nobody knew about.
Fantastic.
I abandoned everything and worked on that. Same thing about the Great Siege documents in Istanbul. I went there totally with a different idea. I went there to see who knows if when they raided Gozo and took away all the people in Gozo in 1551. They might have taken away a couple of papers with some Maltese written on them, you know? That was my idea. Nothing at all. But ended up meeting a person telling me, look, I think there is a whole, you know, there's a whole register, which I saw, Idris Bostan, he was, which I saw years ago on a register about the Siege of Malta.
Maybe it's interesting.
Maybe. And that was it. So that's how it happens, unfortunately.
Well,
unfortunately or fortunately?
Fortunately. Well,
it's unfortunate when you go looking for things which you don't find.
That's frustrating.
That's unfortunate. Yeah.
Well, thank you very, very much, Professor Arnold Cassola, for being with us on Talking Books today. Thank you for listening to Talking Books. I hope you can join us next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.